We're talking about youth gardening here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Educators and people passionate about gardening are in Wisconsin this week. The National Children and Youth Garden Symposium is underway in Madison. And the talks focus on how to help kids develop a green thumb. Share your community garden experiences. What are you growing at home? What's in your plot? What did you plant in your school garden? And parents and teachers, if the children in your life garden, what do you want them to learn? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Beth Tuttle is CEO of the American Horticultural Society, which is based in Alexandria, Virginia. Beth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we live in this age where we're not always connected to nature. We have our smartphones with us, our digital devices everywhere. What is the value of providing children with an outdoor education?
Well, the AHS, the American Horticultural Society, is committed to forging this vital connection between people and plants. And the reason we have such a strong focus on youth gardening is because young people are really the stewards for the environment and for plants in the next generation. Youth gardening is one of those practices that offers just a myriad of benefits that can impact health and nutrition, social and emotional development, their sense of environmental stewardship, and honestly, their academic achievement. And so we look at youth gardening as a gateway and a vital intersection where all of those aspects of the whole child come together.
And some of those youth gardens have come together in the school, in the schoolyard, mm-hmm. and schools building these plots. What do school gardens look like today?
So school gardens take all kinds of forms, and they're very much reflective of the communities that they're trying to serve. And so across the nation, they may take the form of a formal garden that is hosted on the school property that is being used as a regular part of either science, health, language arts, a range of topics may be being, and educational standards may be being addressed in that garden. In others, they may be a volunteer program that's just the school garden club, for example. So they really differ. We are seeing a great growth in habitat gardening for pollinators and to create safe spaces for migratory birds and pollinator bees. We also, of course, see lots of vegetable gardens, but we also see gardens that are designed to address, for example, the cultural diversity of areas that may have very large immigrant populations in their student bodies, and they're a form of cultural expression.
So what happens to the food cultivated in those vegetable gardens?
Well, again, it depends on the school and how it's situated and what its structure is, but there is certainly a very, very strong farm-to-school movement and a very strong movement to integrate the food that children grow onto the tables in the schools so that the children are eating what they grow. In other cases, there are strong relationships that are forged with community food banks so that food that is being grown is going to serve those who have limited or no access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
We're talking with Beth Tuttle. She is president and CEO of the American Horticultural Society. What should people know to garden about the work? And educators, do you have a garden education program at your school? What goals do you have? What does your curriculum look like? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Beth, what kind of science skills do young people develop with exposure to gardening?
Well, they're learning all kinds of skills. Math. So I want to build a 4x4 raised bed. How many cubic feet of dirt do I need? Perfect way to teach a math lesson. They're learning history. Where did this food come from? When was it introduced? Whose culture is it reflective of? And what does it mean in that culture? They're learning a lot about health and nutrition. So those kinds of skills we do have. I mean, we hear regularly last night at dinner, you know, a story of a school garden educator with a student coming up to her with an orange in her hand and saying, "What is this?" And the teacher said, "Well, it's an orange." And she said, "But oranges don't look like this." And the teacher said, "Well, what does an orange look like?" And she said, "Well, it looks like a little smiley thing. She'd only seen oranges cut up." And she said, where is this? And the teacher said, that's inside the orange. Let's cut it up.
Oh, so making that real connection to just what an orange looks like.
Very fundamental connections to your food. Where does it come from? What does it look like?
During the summer months, when we see those school gardens, who keeps them up? How do you keep up gardens? There's a lot of work that goes into gardens. It's not just about the harvest.
That's very, very true. It's actually the reason for the theme of this year's National Children and Youth Garden Symposium, which was building blocks for sustainability. Now, we're all hearing about sustainability in a context of environmental sustainability. This conference is really looking at sustainability across a number of dimensions. And the real three critical ones, of course, environmental sustainability, financial sustainability is another big challenge, and the last one is really the human capital, the sustainability of that, because gardens take work, and they take people who put hands in the dirt. So in many places, you will have a school garden that really runs for a nine-month season. Now, if you talk to somebody who gardens in Florida, you can garden year-round. There are no issues, you know, that you might have here in Wisconsin where your garden season is very short from the beginning of September till maybe the end of October. Okay. And then again, you might have a very short one in the spring. And so the opportunity that exists in those months where you cannot be outdoor gardening is to be indoors. So you could be teaching students lesson plans around how could we extend the growing season in a place where it's cold, where you might not be able to grow the same things that someone else might be able to grow. How do we propagate plants so that they are ready to go and they can get grown large enough in a short season? How do you deal with that indoors? There's all sorts of ways that people deal with that. The human piece, though, is it requires a lot of volunteer help, typically. You really need an engaged teacher, and it's critical that there be support from other parts of the community and from the administration.
And perhaps the parents
and the parents
as well.
Of course. That's what I meant when I was talking about volunteer, because in many places, the parents are also big helpers in the garden.
Yeah. And of course, then finding that plot of land as well. I mean, sometimes you've got just paved over playgrounds and you have to really figure out where that plot is.
And many of the garden educators are extremely intrepid people who will find a plot, you know, a trailer that was put up for temporary school housing, maybe coming down at the end of some need, and that leaves an open spot of terribly depressed, you know, dirt. But if you have an intrepid teacher who spots that open piece of ground, they'll often go to the administration and say, hey, is there a way that we could? And that's how they start.
So really thinking outside the box when you want to start these projects, because you're saying it's not just about the garden, it's about the curriculum.
It's about the curriculum. Lots of resources available for teachers who are interested in starting school gardens or who are interested in the vast amount of collective wisdom that this community of garden educators have. So some of those kinds of resources, there is a website called kidsgardening.org that offers just an array of well-honed curricular resources. Seed Your Future is another one of our partners. It is a movement to help young people in middle school and high school and beyond really see the value of plants, find an interest in the study of horticulture, and ultimately to pursue jobs in horticulture. Because there are lots of jobs in horticulture that are going unfilled today.
We're talking about garden education with Beth Tuttle as our guide. She's CEO of the American Horticultural Society, which is holding a national symposium this week in Madison. Teachers and daycare providers, are you hoping to start a garden for the young people you care for? What do you want them to learn? What do you need to make happen? Is it administrative support? Is it funding, access to the land? If you don't have access to a plot, how do you help your students understand and value green space? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network.
First thing you're going to work on is pulling the weeds out.
Yeah, pulling the weeds out.
My name is Anijah Howard. I'm 12 years old. The first thing that we actually come for is the strawberries, like especially when they're little because they're not nice and sweet.
We are listening to young people talking about their work at the garden at the Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee in Sherman Park. It's part of the Young Farmers Program, which is run through Groundwork Milwaukee, aiming to involve young people in the food system. Talking about the value of youth gardening here on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer Kent. Educators and gardeners from around the country are in Madison this week for a youth gardening symposium. I want to hear from young gardeners. How is your garden doing? Have you been checking in on your school garden? Are you in a summer program where you're spending time learning how things grow? Join in at 800-642-1234. Beth Tuttle heads up the American Horticultural Society, and she stays with us. Beth, you were just talking a little bit there about plant blindness, which is actually something that is a real thing. What is plant blindness?
Well, it is a thing. You know, about, I'd say 100 years ago, maybe 2 out of every 10 people on the planet lived in an urban area. And right now we're here in Wisconsin, which has a lot of rural and agricultural area. By 1990, about 4 in 10 people lived in an urban area. Today, more than half the world's population lives in an urban area. And by the time a child entering primary school turns 40, 70% of the population is going to dwell in urban areas. And if you look at studies, the average U.S. citizen can easily recognize more than 1,000 brands and logos, but can typically name fewer than 10 local plants. So plant blindness is a phenomenon, and it is a term that was coined in 1998 by botanist educators Elizabeth Schussler and James Wandersee. And what it describes is the inability to see and notice the plants in your own environment. People will easily recognize animals, have challenges recognizing plants. And since plants are absolutely essential to life, right? Not just the food we eat, but the clean air we breathe, the water around us, the environmental conditions in which we live, plant blindness really can have disastrous consequences for us as a human race and as a planet.
I wonder, is it just because we don't have as many plants in urban areas, or we don't see wide open spaces with grassland and wild plants growing?
I think it's part. I don't think it's so much. It, in some cases, it is about access to green space, and that is why communities like, I mean, I'm here in Madison, but other communities all over the country, why there is such a strong movement for community greening. And community greening may take the place of reclaiming, you know, underbuilt areas and reclaiming them for green space and bringing it into close proximity. Here where we are on the UW campus, we've got rooftop gardens and places that can be accessible. Even if you're in an indoor setting, you can just get up and out without having to go out into the forest. The school garden brings that plant life and that connection to plants right up close and personal for kids in the places that they are every single day. So it's really where they're living, where they're playing. And for students, school is where they're working, right?
What are some characteristics that a teacher should have as they incorporate gardening into their curriculum? I mean, what if they're not a gardener themselves?
Well, very often they're not gardeners, and that is something that we've learned. The American Horticultural Society has been running the Children and Youth Garden Symposium for 27 years. So we were very early in the youth gardening movement, and we've really focused on this kind of train the teacher approach to it. And early on, it was people who just, what we see is it's either someone who has always loved gardening and then finds this as their path in school, or often it's someone who teaches something else who the school may say, can you do this? And then they're really scrambling to find garden resources, to find garden mentors. So that you bring a healthy, a good school garden teacher needs. They need a healthy dose of curiosity. They need to be really willing to experiment, as all science is experimental in nature, and you have to learn what works and what doesn't work. A real penchant for hands-on learning, and if you want to see your kids absolutely blossom, get them out in the dirt. And a sense of the importance and power of diversity. Because biodiversity and growing a range of things and having a diverse set of options for children and the way they learn, that's how we really address the whole child in the classroom. And so I think all of that is much more important than deep horticultural knowledge, because horticultural knowledge and information about how to start seeds and grow plants, it's readily available. It's readily available from the AHS website at ahsgardening.org. It's readily available from kidsgardening.org. It's readily available from a number of places.
It seems like the society is really taking this very seriously, mm-hmm. this youth generation, because you see the future there. It is the next generation of who you will be mm-hmm. as a society. Mm-hmm. How important is it to kind of pass that torch in gardening?
Well, it's very important. You know, we find that there is a cohort of gardeners who are, you know, in their 50s and older, who have had one kind of life experience. The way people live and where they live is changing. So that is changing people's way of gardening. Right now, what we see in many, many young adults is a real resurgence of interest in plants, in plant-based lifestyle. So plant-based food choices, plant-based product choices. People are highly interested in succulents and houseplants, and partly because they're more portable.
Huh.
And people are moving frequently. Somebody may not have access to a backyard garden. Also growth in the community gardening movement. People are wanting a plot. And the reason they want a community garden may be to grow food for themselves, but it's likely also largely because they want to build relationships with people in their communities.
Speaking of those relationships, parents who want to get a plot going with their kids at home, and, you know, there's that time crunch. There's only so many hours in a day. How do you make time for gardening at home?
Well, I grew up gardening with my kids, and it doesn't mean that they grew up loving gardening, although I am happy to say that my daughter is now working in the land conservation movement, so I think she kind of got close. And my son has some herbs on his porch, so I did my job. You know, how do you make time for it? I think that whether you're doing it right on your windowsill with three little pots of herbs and you're just saying, here, smell and taste this, and then watch what it does to your eggs. You know, do you like your eggs better or worse with it? You know, that's gardening in and of itself. We have to have a broader definition of gardening that doesn't necessarily just match I'm outside, I have a large plot, and I've got tomatoes in cages, because not everybody can do that. Container gardening is a huge opportunity, even if somebody's living in a small apartment, as long as they have some access to sunlight somewhere. You can put a...
Sounds like scale is mm-hmm. something that you really take seriously, that you just don't have to scale up right away or perhaps at all.
Well, and this is definitely not a one-size-fits-all. The same thing doesn't grow everywhere across the country. The same conditions don't exist. People's needs are very different. And so I think it is the ultimate way to be, you know, very authentic, very community-based, to really address the individual needs of the locality and the children. I know you mentioned the piece that we just heard was from a Community Groundworks site, mm-hmm. and we're thrilled to have Community Groundworks as our local partners for this, as well as the Wisconsin School Garden Network and UW-Madison's Environmental Design Lab. We really can't do this conference without those kinds of local partners. So later in the conference, we're going to be touring a number of local sites. And that's one of the things we always build into this, because we move this conference around the country. So we're going to go to school gardens at the Madison Children's Museum, the Troy Kids Garden, the UW-Madison Botany Facility. So we're going to see a different viewpoint of how people are gardening in this city.
For teachers who are out there thinking about their school year next year and, you know, wanting to start a garden and maybe trying to figure out what is my first step, what are those initial first steps?
The first step is to work a bit on getting some administration buy-in if the administration isn't part of that process immediately. Because having access to land and finding a way to either incorporate it into the day or incorporate it into an after school or out of school portion of the program is important. I also, the educators that I talk with say, don't think of it as an extra activity. Think of it as a way to teach the standards that you're already teaching. And then you're doing two things at once, which is always good if you're a teacher because you have to be able to multitask. But you're also providing a different kind of setting for learning. And with all kinds of learners at the table, settings are really important for the different kinds of learners. So some who don't do well in a classroom may do very well in the outdoor setting.
Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Beth Tuttle is president and CEO of the American Horticultural Society. The National Children and Youth Garden Symposium runs through Saturday in Madison. Coming up, states bordering Wisconsin are legalizing marijuana. Next year, recreational marijuana is legal in Illinois, and an attorney explains how that change could affect Wisconsin's marijuana legislation and the way Wisconsinites engage with it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about marijuana legalization in states bordering Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Illinois' governor signed legislation last month, making it the 11th state in the nation to legalize recreational marijuana. Michigan is 4 months away from licensing recreational marijuana businesses. Minnesota lawmakers approved a medical marijuana option in 2014, but has not legalized it for recreational use. So what does this all mean for Wisconsinites who are separated by just a state border? Do you have plans to visit Illinois to buy recreational marijuana next year? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Paloma Kennedy is an associate attorney at Reinhardt Berner Van Duren in Milwaukee, where she focuses on corporate law. She has expertise on Wisconsin laws governing cannabis and CBD products, and she represents cannabis-related businesses and entrepreneurs. Paloma, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
So recreational marijuana can legally be bought, sold, possessed, and consumed in Illinois starting January 1. What kind of economic impact could this have on Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of potential economic impacts. Namely, one of the things that would, I think, be the largest concern moving forward and initially is that Wisconsin already has a shortage in workers, and we're seeing kind of this mass exodus of what I would consider, 25 to 54 in terms of age, leaving the state and not working here. And so with that shortage already being an issue in the state of Wisconsin, I think one of the biggest concerns for Wisconsin as soon as legalization occurs and business permits start to be rolled out in Illinois is what type of workforce will we lose down to Illinois in addition to potentially losing, newfound business in the cannabis industry in general from Wisconsin residents.
Oh, because you see an industry there rising up in Illinois that will attract people away from Wisconsin to that industry in Illinois?
Absolutely.
And you don't have to grow or sell marijuana to make money from it. You can provide equipment for growers. There is a lot of the supported industries growing up around it. What kind of attraction might Illinois have for those entrepreneurs and business owners?
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely ways to participate in the cannabis industry that isn't directly related to growing or manufacturing the product itself. And as a result, I think one of the biggest questions we'll have is, as Wisconsin residents have been waiting for Wisconsin to legalize recreational marijuana here in our state, everyone that has been in this industry already through CBD or from outside state pilot programs, I think the biggest question will be, when everyone has been expecting the gold rush to occur here in Wisconsin in terms of new entrepreneurial business opportunities, what will happen as soon as those opportunities are literally just a state away, especially for a lot of the individuals in Wisconsin that live just over the border? So where we might have had business opportunities here in Wisconsin just waiting to occur, what percentage of Wisconsin residents will already start those businesses and have them be in Illinois instead?
And what are the legal implications for businesses here in Wisconsin that may have an offshoot, a very applicable offshoot in recreational marijuana in Illinois?
Yeah, I think it gets really complicated. There are definitely tax implications in terms of, you know, having to figure out, one, how to have a business that is legal in Illinois, but then cannot be really, you know, worked at all here in Wisconsin. I think that there should be some, advice given to individuals here in Wisconsin that decide to start a business either wholly in Illinois or from the Wisconsin border and then have an offshoot of a business that's doing a registered business in Illinois, doing business down there, is that, you know, a lot of that business will have to be done wholly in the state of Illinois, and individuals who live and work largely in Wisconsin will have to make sure that none of the business that's technically illegal gets, kind of flooded back into Wisconsin on accident.
Talking about our border states to Wisconsin that have legalized marijuana use, Michigan and Illinois recreational marijuana industry, they're forming. We're finding out what that means to Wisconsin with Milwaukee attorney Paloma Kennedy as our guide. She represents cannabis-related businesses and entrepreneurs. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Will you cross the border and perhaps open a business or pursue recreational marijuana after January 1 in Illinois? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Kevin now, joining us from Florence. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yes, I told the gal and answered the phone that don't forget about the UP of Michigan, because they've already had a shop about just a half mile over the state line from Florence, but they had to close this past week due to the whole thing about being the licensing and regulations and everything that they're supposed to have straightened out later in the year.
Kevin, thanks so much for the call. And Kevin is saying, look, you know, recreational marijuana in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is forming. That industry is forming there as well, as they're 4 months away. Is that right, Paloma?
Yeah, the in terms of recreational marijuana kind of getting a fast track from neighboring states, Wisconsin is going to be kind of a late to the game player in terms of everyone around us that's a neighboring state, either already having medical marijuana and then moving towards recreational marijuana legalization, or already in the process of having legalized the recreational use side and just moving more towards getting permits out and starting the entire process of having cannabis grown right there in their state.
Do we know of any workforce trends? Is there traction in the workforce that there are a lot of jobs in the cannabis industry? What does that look like?
So the new legislation just passed by Illinois actually gives credence to individuals who fall under a specific category where they've either been affected by incarceration or some sort of criminal background related to marijuana, or fall under a minority or women-owned business category. And for those individuals, they can actually have special licenses granted to them in Illinois. And part of that is the application is that they have to have a certain number of workers. So there's definitely going to be a push for these applicants. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly from reading the legislation, it was at least 10 workers for that individual at that facility. So, you know, let's just imagine, you know, a number of applicants that are coming in, and each applicant has to have 10 workers in addition to those that are starting the business. You know, that could really have a major effect on how many people from Wisconsin end up getting a job in Illinois and crossing over the border every day instead of keeping them here in our own state.
What does this mean for law enforcement based on what we saw happen in Colorado when Colorado legalized recreational marijuana?
I think we're going to have a lot of the same issues. After Colorado legalized marijuana, they actually created a report showing kind of what was happening to the marijuana that had been legally grown in the state and then, you know, supposedly kept within state borders. And one of the issues was that there was an increase in trafficking. So a lot of the neighboring states to Colorado saw an increase in the amount of what was technically recreational marijuana grown and sold in Colorado being driven across state lines and then having it trafficked across the United States. And this was both at, you know, what I would consider pirate grows, which was kind of the term used in Colorado where individuals were, you know, shirking the tax because it was really high in Colorado and pretty much continuing illegal growth without a permit and then having those kind of trickle through into more organized criminal groups.
Let's take another call now with Mike joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hey there. So I wonder if this whole discussion should kind of be, you know, like tempered by the fact that the federal government still has a prohibition on marijuana across the entire country. And so technically, there's not any legal marijuana industry anywhere across the country. It's part of the reason why growers in Colorado are having difficulty depositing their money because they can't just take it in the banks because it falls into a whole different category. And the federal government could come and shut this whole thing down at any time.
Mike, thanks for the call. Paloma, what do we know about federal oversight?
At this point, the federal government has really taken a hands-off approach. But he's absolutely correct. I mean, if they decided at any point to come in and decide that they were no longer going to allow some of the actions that are being taken at the state level, they could come in and take more of an enforcement approach, which they have threatened to do in terms of Colorado having a lot of illegal growth operations. But in terms of allowing states to create their own laws, you know, that's part of the whole division of power in our country. The states are allowed to kind of separate themselves from federal government. It doesn't stop the fact that our federal laws do make it illegal, and he's absolutely right. You know, I think a lot of businesses have had struggles with how to have the revenue come in and then how, one, to deposit that money because it's in cash form, and two, how to pay taxes, which has been a continuing issue in Colorado for a lot of those businesses.
And speaking of taxes, tax dollars, will we see an uptick of the number of police patrolling the state border for people bringing in marijuana from Illinois?
I think it'll kind of be a no-brainer for Wisconsin in terms of having to maybe provide greater law enforcement. It was one of the solutions that neighboring states and Colorado itself ended up taking up in order to try and reduce the amount of trafficking. Granted, the laws surrounding search and seizure are very complicated, and so I'm not quite sure how those law enforcement in Colorado and the neighboring states decided to, you know, in terms of enforcement, find out and or pull over individuals to try and stop the trafficking. But I'm assuming that those law enforcement individuals in the state and outside the state had worked together.
Talking with Milwaukee attorney Paloma Kennedy. She stays with us. She represents cannabis-related businesses. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What do you think this means for the way Wisconsin polices and regulates marijuana? How do you want to see Wisconsin lawmakers think about marijuana? Will you cross state lines or start a business just across the border? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. Talking about marijuana being legalized in 3 out of the 4 states that surround Wisconsin and what that means for our residents. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 11 states have legalized marijuana for recreational purposes, Illinois being the latest. And a new jobs report by a marijuana information site called Leafly estimates that there are 211,000 marijuana-related jobs in our country, and that number is growing. It refers to the industry's growth as America's hidden job boom. Do you plan to start a business in Illinois or move across state lines because of recreational marijuana being legalized? Are you hopeful that Wisconsin will take steps to legalize it? We're at 800-642-1234. Milwaukee attorney Paloma Kennedy is our guide, and she represents cannabis-related businesses. Let's go back to the phones now with Trish joining us from Nina. Hi, Trish.
Good morning. I was just wondering, and I realize this is maybe somewhat peripheral, but how does the legalization of the use of marijuana potentially affect those who have been incarcerated because of their use of it and possession of it at the time when this was an illegal thing?
Great question, Trish. Paloma, what insights do we have there on incarceration?
Each state has handled previous incarceration and or criminal history related to possession in different ways. In Illinois, it's going to be the broadest in terms of how they've been able to pass through legislation a way for individuals to have that history completely expunged. So Illinois is going to definitely be the broadest until other states come into play, and then we'll know whether they still remain the broadest. It has, in its legislation, put that if anyone has been convicted of possession of 30 grams or less, that would be automatically expunged without having to do anything, and then anything 30 to 500 grams would have to require a petition, but that would also be expunged as well.
Governor Evers has called for legalizing medical marijuana and decriminalizing possession of small amounts. What does support among lawmakers currently look like here in Wisconsin?
It's definitely a rocky road. There's been a lot of push throughout the years to try and legalize marijuana here in Wisconsin, but we really just haven't been able to get there from a policymaking perspective. Back in 2018, we had a couple of referendums that were put out for voting. Those actually passed with popular votes here in Wisconsin. So there is support from our citizenship. It's just a matter of having the individuals at the top help push it forward.
Let's take another call now. Tom joining us from Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Good morning. I would like to say two things real quick. One, in a country swimming in alcohol, opiate, and prescription drug abuse, the thought of now legalizing another drug is just absolutely absurd. And as far as workers fleeing the state to jobs in adjoining states in the marijuana industry, I think that's a categorically false idea. And I really don't think that there are enough workers that are going to be in the marijuana industry that's really going to substantially dent the workers in Wisconsin.
Tom, thanks for the call. Starting with the first half of his thoughts there, are there other drug issues in our country coming up as states weigh the future of marijuana, Paloma?
I definitely think having another type of substance legalized in states, and especially here in Wisconsin, potentially in the future, could be an issue. I mean, Wisconsin has already struggled with drunk driving. You know, impaired driving from other substances continues to be an issue, even in states where it's not legal. So obviously this will remain at the forefront.
Let's take another call. Joe joining us from Pleasant Prairie with thoughts on this. Joe, hi.
Hi.
What are you thinking about marijuana and our border states?
We were talking about, or you were talking about, jobs and things that are happening in the state of Illinois, right next to Wisconsin. And I'm an entrepreneur, and I've started a company. I've been in business before in Wisconsin. I raised $5 million to move my medical production equipment company to the state of Illinois. So in addition to actually moving the company, there will be about 20 employees from Wisconsin that will be moving their jobs there as well.
So you have a plan in place to move your manufacturing company to Illinois as Illinois ramps up for recreational use?
Yes.
And so what is your timeline for opening up in Illinois?
Started in process already. We already raised the funds. We've got state support. We've got local tax support. We're ready to go. We're actually in the process of planning.
What do you see promising about this industry from a business standpoint?
Interestingly enough, it's similar to the pharmaceutical manufacturing arena when you talk about medical marijuana and things like that. So it's a nice offshoot from what's been standard in the industry for numbers of years in the pharmaceutical arena. This is actually mimics it, so it brings a lot more opportunities for manufacturing and production, sales, retail, everything.
Paloma, he's drawing parallels there to what has happened in the pharmaceutical industry. What do you see?
I definitely think that there is, you know, potential and great opportunity here to tie in the cannabis industry to what has been occurring in the pharmaceutical realm, just from the perspective that the two are kind of getting tied together, just from the perspective that a lot of individuals have started to associate recreational marijuana as well as CBD products, both with THC content and without, as having medicinal qualities. And so you're seeing a lot of CBD products pop up throughout the United States in mainstream stores, and also mom and pop owned shops, you know, locally owned, small independent stores. And a lot of individuals are starting to adopt using CBD and also recreational marijuana to kind of curb their own medical issues without really seeking medical advice. And so there's a lot of parallels that can be drawn between the two industries because it is health related. I think Joe makes a really good point in terms of, I believe an earlier caller was discussing how there is not really a potential to have an impact on workforce here in Wisconsin. In addition to potentially drawing people away from Wisconsin, there is a potential to draw away entrepreneurship from Wisconsin that would normally be here and be starting businesses right on our home turf. In addition, a lot of individuals could be raising money from the state of Wisconsin and potential investors here in our state and then taking that money out of our state. So the whole point of economic development here in Wisconsin is to really help self-fund us. And if people are raising money and taking it across the state line, it is completely to the detriment of our own internal plan for economic growth.
Let's try to squeeze in one more call here. Ryan in Eau Claire. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Just wanted to say I'm with the one of the last callers here that says we have already so many epidemics and we tend to race into things way too quick. We don't look at the impacts it's had on other states close enough. The other thing is the money it brings in. I mean, our government already funds so many support groups for other addictions already, and now we just add another one to it. So
Ryan's,
you know,
saying,
bring in money,
yeah,
but do we really look at the impact that it has negatively before we just race into it like a little kid?
Ryan's saying, yeah, another layer here, Paloma, that we've ramped up too quickly on this industry. And just have a bit of time left for your final thoughts. What are you watching for? Where is this headed?
I think that this is obviously a complicated landscape for every state that endeavors to enter into legalizing recreational marijuana. Obviously, there's a big push here to increase tax revenue. I think that any state that is headed towards legalization, obviously has a late entry advantage here because Colorado has really gone through a lot of the ups and downs, the bumps, to kind of work out what has and hasn't in terms of, you know, what in the legislation needed to be changed, how can enforcement be modified. There's a lot going on in terms that continues in terms of quality of production. You know, we're finding out that a lot of the plants that are being grown have pesticides and other sorts of issues with the product itself, and none of it's being governed because the FDA isn't really involved. And so it'll continue to evolve, and I think it'll continue to be complicated as we move forward.
Paloma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Paloma Kennedy is an associate attorney at Reinhardt Berner Van Duren in Milwaukee. She represents cannabis-related businesses and entrepreneurs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.